Vision Daily Briefing, live without a net, Friday edition. I'm live with Ed Harrison and Jack Farley. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Great to be here. Ash, you have the net, right?
There is no net, Jack. There is no net.
Ash, you had one job.
Talking of one job, you guys obsessively watching markets all week long, your one job. Tell us, what are you seeing? What's crossed your attention? And what's important for people to know right now?
Hey, Jack, I mean, you and I, right before I started talking, we were talking about the same thing, earnings. I know the market's down today, and you're going to give us the numbers, Ash, but earnings have been really good. And Jack, he ran through a bunch of numbers that were very nice. Why don't you tell us what those numbers look like, Jack?
Sure, Ed. Well, so far, about a few hundred companies have reported their earnings of the S&P 500, and about 90% of them have actually beaten the expectations from the street. Now, many say that those expectations are artificially low so to make the companies look good. And of course, that's true. But 90% is still very high. In fact, I was reading a paper earlier that found that the average beat for S&P 500 companies over the past 5 years was around 74%. So 90% is very good. And to give you another point of context, in the KBW Bank Index, it's an index that has 24 bank stocks. Ed, do you want to take a guess how many of those 24 bank stocks beat their earnings?
Well, I'm guessing since I saw on my screen that the bank stocks hit 52-week highs today, that the answer is every single one.
Yes, that is exactly true. I'm actually surprised that you got that. And every 24 of 24 made that. I actually was making a chart earlier. It's a remarkable chart. So yeah, earnings good across the board. Today, in terms of price action, you had Asia open up very weak, the Hang Seng down about 2%. That weakness bled into U.S. equity markets. Ash can tell us about that later. Bonds very flat. You saw a little commodity weakness as well, but that's the price action. I want to get into the big themes with you guys.
Yeah, let me just say before we got in too deep, for people who have missed the close, Dow Jones Industrial Average closing at 33,874, down about 185 points on the day, or down 0.5-ish%. S&P closing at 4,181, down around 0.75%, and NASDAQ off about 0.85%, closing below the 14,000 level at 13,962. Jack, I got a question for you. When we talk about this, beat, miss calculus, is it worth pointing out, as you point out, obviously there is clearly the thought that companies put them a little bit lower than they'd like so they can have a beat. But what about the magnitude of some of these beats? I'm thinking Google here. Clearly, that must matter, the degree to which a company beats the earnings. And I'll just throw one other thing out for you, Jack. In my conversation with Tommy Thornton on Tuesday, he observed that when there are blowout beats and companies don't get rewarded by it for investors, that's a sign that maybe, potentially, things may start to be looking a little toppy.
Ash, two great points there. Yeah, you mentioned Google. So the expectation from the street for adjusted earnings per share was $15.63. It reported $26.29, so a surprise of 68%. Now, you sometimes see that with small caps that maybe aren't that well covered, but for a huge mega cap behemoth like Google, it really was quite striking. And then to that point of Tommy Thornton, you're absolutely right. We did see an earnings beat of about 9-10% of Microsoft, but even that, the Wall Street analysts, even though their number were beat, the street was not very happy with that stock actually trading down. So you did see that phenomenon that Tommy mentioned.
Yeah. Ed, what say you?
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about the Fang M, and I'm thinking about them as the new value. I know this is kind of, I was talking to someone about this earlier in an interview, and, you know, when they're trading at 30 times earnings, it's hard to call them value stocks. But they're the new stalwarts in an interesting way, because a lot of them have traded sideways from a PE perspective or down. Let me tell you across the board what the PEs of the Fang M are. We're looking at 34 times for Microsoft. Facebook is trading at 28 times. Apple is trading at almost 30 times, just $29.95. Amazon is the outlier, but they're only trading at 66 times. And remember, that's because they're supposedly reinvesting so much money into the business that, you know, the net income doesn't represent the free cash flow that they're spinning off. And then finally, if you look at Google, aka Alphabet, they're trading at 31 times earnings. So what that's telling you is that these biggest companies are trading at multiples that are much more in line with the market. They're not trading at the huge premium that they traded to the market in. And then, so when we think about where you're going to invest your money going forward in this economy, those are places where you're not going to get beat up, whether or not you have inflation, whether or not, you know, there's some sort of lockdown that comes out of the blue, because obviously they did well in the pandemic. These are becoming the new stalwarts to invest in. They're the new value. That's how I'm thinking of it. I'm still trying to put together a thesis in terms of thinking about it, but I'm not looking at it as in Microsoft was down on the day. I'm looking at it over time that they're much more in line with the market. They represent compelling value at these levels relative to the rest of the market.
Yeah, I mean, the average, it looks like the average PE on the NASDAQ 100 right now is over 40 spot 34 on 423, according to the most recent data from Wall Street Journal Markets.
Yeah. And
so go ahead, Jack.
Well, I think both of you make such good points. Obviously, these stocks are growth stocks because they grow very quickly. Typically, people, investors, assigning a premium to that, but they are trading at a price to earnings multiple that is somewhat reasonable. I'd also add, I'm a journalist. I don't really opine on these matters, but on an absolute basis, I don't really have a view. But relatively, I mean, where else are you going to put your money? You're going to put it in a place like a stock like Chipotle, which has it's a fixed asset business that has a price to earnings multiple in the 50s. Are you going to invest it in some, let's say, SPAC where the CEO has never had a real job? You know, I mean, I think that the FANGs, that they remain a very good place to put your money. They've had extremely consistent returns. I also think that one reason passive has outperformed active is that the active managers try and be very clever and, you know, underweight FANGs, and that has really hurt them. By FANGs, I mean, of course, Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Google, those sorts of stocks.
Yeah. And let me say, by the way, here's an interesting wrinkle here, is if you go across the board and you look at the beta of these stocks and how they're trading, this goes right in line with what you're saying. Alphabet is trading at, its beta is 1.03. Amazon has a beta of 1.15. Apple has a beta of 1.21. Facebook, 1.3. And then to top it off, Microsoft, the big daddy, 0.79. So this is a stock that the volatility is incredibly low relative to the market.
Yeah. I mean, Microsoft has been just a cash machine now for years, and that seems to be the case moving forward. And you actually see that now in the fact that it's got lower volatility than the overall S&P.
So here's the question I have for you guys. When we look at something like Amazon, I think Amazon made net income of something like $8 billion. Their trailing 12-month earnings are $27 billion. Is that a high watermark for growth for them? Can they continue to replicate that? Are the beats very difficult going forward? Because I've heard a lot of people talking about this coming quarter as going to be a more difficult quarter. And maybe this is why these guys are selling off, is because, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news. There's nothing else to be gained. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, this is an interesting question. I think people who have been bearish on Amazon, even at valuations above 60, have historically run into some problems with that short trade, I think it's fair to say. But look, there is a question here ultimately about what the law of large numbers starts to look like. We are at $1.75 trillion or so in market cap on Amazon right now. And you have to wonder, how much growth can there be when you're approaching $2 trillion? Now, I suppose you could say that Amazon can continue to grow and become more powerful and represent a greater percentage of, for example, cloud services or retail. But there's a certain point where you begin to attract the attention of regulators, and regulators look and go, hey, when the market cap of this company starts to be a reasonable fraction of US GDP, maybe that's time to take a look at it. So it seems to me, and again, you've been wrong if you've gone against it, but at a certain point, you have to wonder, does the growth begin to taper from a market cap perspective? Is there really just simply no way for it to continue going on? I don't know. That's my thought. What do you think, Jack?
I happen to believe that the FANG stocks do offer opportunity relative to the other stocks, especially the hyper growth stocks. I think Amazon has been an incredibly consistent performer, and I do think that there are opportunities for it to grow. Yeah.
But
let me give you a thought here about these stocks, because you know when Apple released their earnings, they said that they were going to be buying back like $90 billion in shares. Someone said that that's more than 70 components of the S&P 500 to the total market capitalization. And what's more is, they upped their dividend by a ridiculous amount at the same time. These are now the stalwarts. These are the companies. It's almost as if, another thing in terms of talking about value or the betas being like one is these are companies that are almost the bond proxies in a world in which, people are concerned about bonds. If you want to get a dividend or you want to get a coupon, clip the coupon via the dividend of Apple, knowing that, they're going to trade with the market. They are the market in some cases.
Yeah, trade with the market in terms of volatility, but consistently outperformance. So bond-like volatility, equity-like returns. I also add that, these companies, Ash, you're making such a good point about regulation, but I think that really is the only headwind. And if these companies can manage to finagle their way out and not be regulated, not be broken up, one thinks of Facebook, of course, as being most vulnerable to that. I think that the highway is there, the runway is there. And to echo Michael Saylor, who has his view on Bitcoin, he said, if you're not long, you're short. And I kind of think that way about the FANGs. If you're not long these stocks, which really are the bedrock of the American economy and have shown amazing potential to consistently grow, then you're kind of short them.
All right, I'll make the counter case just because it needs to be made. Look, if you were to say the phrase, the only thing that we see for this company that looks like a headwind to me is the potential threat of regulation, and it was Standard Oil in 1911, it would be a pretty consistent headwind. Look, I'll throw out some numbers. About $21 trillion, that's the size of U.S. GDP 2019. Amazon now, again, approaching a market cap of $1.8 trillion. Is there a certain point when it crosses, say, 10% of U.S. GDP, where folks on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue in the Capitol start to say, wow, this is really something that begins to look like it poses a threat, a concentration risk to the broader U.S. economy, competitiveness, small business, a whole series of other risks. I'm not saying that that's a certainty. I'm just suggesting that there is a point at which there becomes almost a kind of de facto ceiling for growth on these companies. And the trajectory just can't continue indefinitely.
I'm not saying
let me give you the counter to that. Because as soon as you said that, I said, let me look up the return on equity for Standard Oil. Because I immediately thought of Standard Oil of Indiana, Standard Oil of New Jersey, Standard Oil of New York. I mean, the broken up pieces of Standard Oil, Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, I mean, they're behemoth companies. For a long time, you probably outperformed. You say the same thing about AT&T. You look at the broken up pieces, Verizon being the most obvious company to be, I would call the new AT&T as opposed to AT&T itself. How would you do in terms of your return on equity with that? So it's almost as if perhaps being broken up isn't a bad thing for them. It takes the overhang of regulation off of the companies, and they can still grow in their respective verticals.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in AT&T country out in northwestern New Jersey, and that 1984 divestiture was really a benchmark for what then was kind of almost the Microsoft of its day. You could think of it as it was sort of the evil empire in a way. The Microsoft, what Microsoft was in 2000, maybe what Facebook was in 2020, AT&T was in the 1980s. And you look at what came out of that, all the what they called the RBOCs, the original Bell operating companies. But in addition to that, companies like, as you point out, Verizon and clearly and Lucent, which was for a time a market leader, obviously made some bad bets. But you really can't blame the mistakes that some of those breakup companies made on the breakup. Certainly, it seems like the potential to liberate an enormous amount of value for the shareholders. But, and this is the interesting point, is really the company being operated for the value of the shareholder, and might they not do better with a divestiture scenario? But when you have these incredibly powerful, charismatic executives who are the founders of these companies, leading them, whether or not they retain the CEO role, whether they call themselves chairman of the board, they are clearly a massive, massive force in these companies. And I'd add one other thing, which is the multiple classes of common stock, which allow these founders to have super voting rights in these companies in perpetuity. You take a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, who's clearly in his 30s right now, very long runway, could be running this company for 50 years. By the way, I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. You could argue the counter case, which is you had great American companies that were run by charismatic founders who had a vision, who then took the company public. You think of Steve Jobs being the most obvious example, lost control of his own company. Apple, the quintessential example, the great American company today, went through years of significant difficulties after John Sculley fired Steve Jobs.
Yeah, all of these questions, I mean, I don't think we have the answers, but at least we have the questions, right? That's the important thing. We're definitely at a critical juncture in this particular cycle, because all the rotation that we have that was emblematic of the reflation trade is now moving to the reopening, the full reopening. And the full reopening trade, it's not clear to me what that trade is and what the pitfalls in that trade are. And I think the segue from equities into any other topic is because everyone's talking about inflation. I don't know if you saw what the BEA released today in terms of personal income and outlays, but I quoted it on Twitter saying that the first line that they had there was something in the order of 21%. They said personal income increased $4.21 trillion or 21.1% at a monthly rate in March. That's a ridiculous amount. This is the wall of money that's about to hit the economy. And a lot of people are short on the bond side because they think that's going to lead to inflation. And I know Jack, he's probably got the stats to talk about that.
Yeah, well, let's see. There's an article from Bloomberg that one in four shares in the ETF TLT, it's a $12 billion bond fund that owns long duration treasuries, duration of 20 years and more. One in four of those shares is now sold short. So you have the potential for a minor short squeeze phenomenon, if not a squeeze, a phenomenon where as the price increases, sellers have to sell. And gamma squeezes, these things happen every day. But yeah, there's a short, very high short interest that we haven't seen since 2017. So the bond short remains on.
And let me just say, for people who are not following this as closely as Jack is, when TLT rises in price, yields fall, and the obvious converse is true as well. So that's a play for rising rates when you see that number falling.
Yep, and selling something short is when you sell something that you don't own.
So it's like a double or triple negative.
Yeah, and if you buy a put option on it, then you're dealers have to synthetically have that position. So it's basically like when you go to put option, you're having the same impact in the market pretty much.
You're melting brains, Jack. I'm not even going to let you talk about gamma hedging.
As he starts talking about synthetic, you know that he's melting brains. Someone's pounding beers right now and watching this. You know?
Yeah.
This is dreamy. Actually, I think there was one RVDB where you were accused of pounding a beer midstream there, Ash.
Green tea, ubiquitous green tea.
Excellent. So let me tell you, I think that it is interesting when Jack talks about the short and the potential for a short squeeze, because if you think back about the price action during the reopening, during the reflation trade, we went from 90 basis points on the 10-year U.S. Treasury all the way up to 175. I think we got as high as 178. before we slid back into the 150s, and now we're just above 160. So the question is, where do we go from here? And that slide that we had from the 170s, the high 170s to the 150s, coincided with a massive unwinding of a short position. But it seems almost from the numbers that Jack is giving us that that short position is back on. And to me, that says not that we're definitely going to get the long bond with yields going higher. It could mean that we actually get yields going lower very quickly because everyone has to cover their shorts because of a short squeeze.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. And something that I know that you're passionate about, more of the big picture structural question, is talking a little bit about the Phillips curve and what some of the economic philosophy is behind this and why it's happening. But first, I should say, if you see Jack and I getting brighter suddenly for no reason, the sun has just come out on the Upper East Side.
Yeah, it's the roaring 20s.
It's not the beer that you guys are pounding.
No, no. So, Ed, you want to talk about the Phillips? Because I got a question. You said that, you know, the yields could go lower because of the short squeeze, but that's like saying, oh, this stock went down so much, it has to go back up. You know, some sub-stocks that appear to be a value, I think they're a value trap. Like, what if there's a reason that everyone is short bonds? And namely, the economy is reopening before our eyes, you know, commodity is soaring. Yeah, so I don't know.
And the bet is that rates are going to rise, right?
Exactly. Well, that's
exactly why Ash is making the segue into the Phillips curve, because, yeah, that's what people are saying. I mean, I think Muhammad Al-Aryan says it pretty well. And there are some other people who are saying this as well. Bill Dudley, the former New York Fed president, they're saying that basically what's going to happen is that it used to be that the Fed was preemptive about inflation. They would see signs that inflation were percolating, like the things that you were just talking about, Jack. And then they would preemptively tighten to make sure that it didn't get embedded and spiral out of control. What people like Dudley are saying, and actually Muhammad Al-Aryan as well, is that what the Fed's new regime is, there's a clear regime shift under Powell. What they're saying is we're going to wait until we actually see the whites of inflation's eyes. We're going to wait until the inflation is actually right on top of us. We see it, it's actually happening, and only then will we tighten. And what Dudley, Muhammad Al-Aryan, and many others, Larry Summers is another one, they're all saying is you'll have waited too long because of the long and variable lag in how monetary policy works. You're going to have to stomp on the brakes in a massive way. Dudley was quoted as saying we'll get to at least 3.5 or 4% on the 10-year in this new framework that Powell and the Powell Fed are using.
So Vice Chairman Dudley, Ed, says very well the thing you disagree with most.
Yes, definitely. I completely disagree with him because what's behind this is this perverse Phillips curve stuff. The basically what he's saying is that when you get unemployment going down too low, that's when inflation happens. So what happens is that you get to a point when there's so few extra workers in the economy to hire that inflation starts to go up because you're bidding up wages. And when you bid up wages, more people have money in their pockets and they start buying stuff and the price of those things go up and everything spirals out of control. he's saying we need to stop that from happening. And the way that we're going to do it, and this is what he said when he was a Fed chair or a Fed president, he said in 2017, quote, if we were not to withdraw accommodation, the risk would be that the economy would crash to a very, very low unemployment rate and generate inflation. So in order to make sure that we don't get that inflation, let's throw people out of work. Let's raise rates, throw people out of work. And by doing that, we will stop the inflation bugaboo from hitting us.
The economy crash to a low rate of unemployment. It's exactly. Terrible, Ed. Everyone's working.
Yeah. Crash to a very, very low unemployment rate. And you see the wording there, you caught the crash, but even the very, very low, as if very, very low unemployment rates are bad. That's what he's saying. He's saying a low, low unemployment rate crashes the economy, so we have to jack up rates. This is the paradigm that Summers is using, that Muhammad Alarian's using, that Bill Dudley's using. That's the old paradigm, and that's the paradigm where at the end of the cycle, just when you thought your paycheck was going to start, you know, humming along with everyone else, asset prices have been going up, but your paycheck is not. Just when, you know, things are getting going, kabam, the Fed comes in, they start jacking up rates, and the whole cycle falls apart. And, you know, half of the people who got into the cycle at the end get unemployed again. So to me, that's a perversity. And the question is, if you don't do that, what happens to inflation? Because that's the regime that we're in now. They're not doing that anymore.
Ed, I've got a question for you. To what degree is Bill Dudley, is Larry Summers, do they still exert influence? It's my understanding that these people are kind of on the outs. You know, they are well respected, but they are not in positions of power. In other words, like people who are actually on the FOMC committee, their opinion matters a lot more than what these people who are writing columns matters, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that this is where the proof is in the pudding in terms of the bond vigilantes, because I think of the bond vigilantes as front runners. I don't think of them as intimidators. They're not intimidating the Fed into doing what they want to do. The Fed said over and over again, many members of the Fed, that we're just going to do what we want to do. We're looking at the stuff that we're going to look at, and we've told you what it is, and that's it. But the bond vigilantes are saying, we think you have it wrong. We think that Summers, Alarian, and Dudley are right, that when we get to the point that all this stimulus gets into the system, inflation will rise so much that you guys are going to have to slam on the brakes. And so we are going to front run that and send rates up ahead of time. So that's where the short position comes from, because they think they can benefit from this eventuality.
Yeah. Right. Ed, I want to point out that. Sorry, go ahead, Ash.
No, I was just going to say, just to underline this point, the big picture issue here is, you know, what we've seen is we've seen this tremendous run up in asset prices, particularly in U.S. equity markets over the last 5 years. And the point is one that's very well taken, which is just as the economy begins to start humming along in a way that ordinary wage earners begin to participate in it with some job stability, with some opportunities, maybe some overtime, those kinds of things. Then suddenly you start hearing talk about taking away the punch bowl. And, you know, the question is, and look, we can argue the converse. We can see right now that all item CPI is above 2%. Obviously, there's always a risk of things overheating, but it really does seem the definition of inflation, this idea of a general rise in prices. We know that there's energy price inflation. That's a huge factor when you look at all item. When you net it out and just look at core, it's much more modest, much more moderate. But really, the inflation that people are feeling, if you talk to ordinary Americans, people who aren't economists, who are sitting at the kitchen table paying bills, they talk about generally, it's the same three things that I keep hearing. Number one, healthcare is terrifying for everyone, right? You lose your job and, you know, you just need something as simple as an appendectomy, and suddenly you wind up in debt for a decade. Terrifying thing. Prices have been rising consistently in healthcare. Number two, the cost of education. Ask any parent in America. It's crippling. It's terrifying. It's awful. And number three, the thing that we're hearing increasingly is about the price of food inflation. It's something, you know, that I feel certainly that when you go out to get a hamburger, there clearly is a rise rise in the price of food. Ed, what do you think about that from the broader perspective, from the perspective of what Americans feel when they look at their bills at the end of the month?
Well, I think of the anecdote you told right before we came on about Bill Dudley, you know, being one of these economists who was talking about iPads, you know, and deflation. The guy's not living in the real world. He's living in his world of models. That's the kind of inflation you're talking about. Another part of inflation that I worry about, where the two come right together, that is asset price inflation and real inflation in the real world, is house prices. Because for the first time, we're seeing not just house prices going up, which is the asset price inflation slash real inflation for those who aren't owners, but we're also seeing apartment prices reflect this. So when you price people out of the market in, you know, first-time home buyers, they're going to start, you know, bidding up the price of rentals. And so that's a part of inflation that is very pernicious. It's one of the largest in the inflation basket. And that's the sort of thing that, yes, down the line, it could surprise the Fed and cause them to do exactly as Dudley and all the rest of them are saying is going to happen.
Well, you know, absolutely. And now you have not just this challenge where you talk about, you know, the interests of people who own assets versus the interests of people who don't, but you also have an intergenerational impact where you have people, perhaps blue collar workers who bought houses 30 years ago, and you look at where they are compared to their kids who are in similar jobs, and it is a real, real significant challenge for the country. By the way, I should say, though, with regard to Mr. Dudley, apparently, I believe I owe him an apology. I just Googled that iPad story, March 14th, 2011, for CNBC. The headline I wrote about the iPad story, Fed President Impersonates Marie Antoinette. That was probably unfair. Funny, but unfair.
Excellent. Yes. Let me say one other thing. I have an interview that's very interesting coming up with Dario Perkins, who is someone who's very sympathetic to the shift in policy. But he's talking about actually the fiscal policy shift. There are two shifts that are going on simultaneously. There's the one that we're talking about, the whites of the eyes Fed policy shift. And then there's the fiscal shift that we see with Bidenomics, that it does seem is catching a bid also in Europe as well. What Dario is saying is that it's the fiscal side where, you know, deficit spending, putting money in people's pockets directly, really is going to be the thing that down the line leads to more inflation. That's the thing that is going to make a difference for wage earners, but also eventually lead to more inflation. What, if it were me and I were running policy, I would have a much more loose fiscal and tighter monetary policy. I wouldn't have loose, and I wouldn't have tight. And if I had to choose one to be loose with, it would be fiscal over monetary.
Yeah, a very nuanced point there, Ed. Unfortunately, it's one that relies on Congress to get things done, as opposed to, you know, 12 men and women in a room on the FOMC. I should probably say we're getting a lot of comments coming into us, a lot of questions. We should probably jump in and ask them. The first one is precisely to this point from BadBoy54377. What do you guys make of Fed Governor Kaplan's remarks today? In case you haven't seen it, Fed Governor Kaplan out of Dallas Fed has basically called for beginning to think about raising rates.
Isn't that what the Bonneville Jannies are telling you? They're telling you that Kaplan, and he's a hawk, you know, he's more hawkish, that this is the direction of travel, that at the margin, we're going to see the Fed moving in the direction of the markets as opposed to the reverse. So they're all piling in to the negative bets. It's interesting. I have sympathy for that concept, that the Fed is not as impervious to the changes in the real economy as they make it out to be.
Yeah, I think it's an important point. So on the one hand, he's saying similar things to Larry Summers and to, sorry, who was the other gentleman who was?
Muhammad Al-Arian.
No, the other one.
Bill Dudley.
Bill Dudley, yeah, he's saying similar things to Bill Dudley and Larry Summers. However, a huge difference in that, you know, Robert Kaplan is a president of the Dallas Fed. He actually has real power, unlike those other people who are kind of like Junior from The Sopranos. Like they were a character who had a lot of power now, but they are on the outs. Whereas Robert Kaplan is more he's in the crew. He's doing the action. So I think that is very significant. However, as you say, Ed, he is known to be somewhat of a hawk. I think it remains to be said, though. I mean, we had Powell's address on Wednesday. The Federal Reserve remains committed to price stability, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and manageable unemployment. And it really wants to get unemployment much, much lower. And I think the Fed has been pretty clear, if you take them at their word, that they are not going to taper unless they see unemployment well below where it is now.
What hey, Jack, I should add, throw in the Sopranos metaphor of your choosing, but Governor Kaplan, not on the FOMC, not a voting member this term.
Right, but he is still within the body of the Fed, but
yeah,
thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And let me say, by the way, that when we think about this going forward, we've got to think that the question really is how quickly do we get down to low levels of unemployment? Because the quicker we get there, if we believe that that's where the Fed is, the more likely they are to raise. And I think that the implicit statement that you're making, Jack, is that the Fed is a de facto employment mandate dominator. That is that the employment mandate is now dominant over the inflation mandate. And what we have to be watching is the level of unemployment. The rate of inflation is less important in this new paradigm.
Yeah. Yes. And in fact, they want to overshoot that 2% target, and they think that they derive that authority because they have undershot it for so long.
Yeah. By the way, questions absolutely blowing up. I think we have more questions on this episode than we ever have before. So I'm going to dive back in.
Coming.
And hit some of them. Tommy Cow, 555Q, how do you evaluate crypto tokens when we don't have the visibility to their financials while all cryptocurrencies are appreciating against fiat in addition? Tommy, that is the $2 trillion question. It's a great one. For example, with Bitcoin, the internal financials obviously are not quite like what you would see with an equity. It is transparent in the sense that you can see the number of wallet addresses, you can gauge transaction volume. But for some of the more abstract ones, you're exactly right. It's just a bet on the future, a highly speculative bet on the future, but one that investors in the space believe is worth thinking about because of the trajectory that bet has taken in the past. And I should say, as we were talking offline, A16Z, that's Andreessen Horowitz, are looking to raise a new fund, $800 million to $1 billion. That would effectively double their exposure to the space. I think they're at about $515 million on their last fund. Hot, red hot. Also, final point, a report coming out of Stratfor talking about Ethereum potentially going to 10,000 today, trading obviously at about a quarter of that right now, looking at network effects and things that are very similar to what our own Raoul Powell has been saying for some time.
Let's get some more of these questions.
All right. Here's another one. Also from Tommy Cow, actually, as I see, are we headed towards Japanification, Ed?
Yeah, I would say that is less likely. The way that I would describe Japanification is I would say that basically you had a problem in terms of the paradigm shift. Japan was stuck in the old paradigm, but they needed to move to the new fiscal dominance paradigm. So one way to think about it is that they said, look, here's what we're going to do is we are going to shock the system with massive deficit spending every time we have a recession, and that shock will help us get out of the recession, and then we'll move to a new sustainable economy. But every single time that happened, they would immediately start raising taxes before they got to full employment. And then they would fall back into a recession again. Then they would go with massive deficit spending. And then, the economy would get back on its feet again. And then they would, again, try to tax away that benefit rather than waiting for the economy to get to full employment again. Meanwhile, they were subsidizing the losers, or what people call zombies, in the corporate space. There was no structural adjustment whatsoever because they had zero rates and they were doing quantitative easing. So they continued to do this over and over again, and that is futile. We have done that in the United States really for 12 years. Are we going to do it for another bunch of years? It all depends on where the Fed goes, because as I said, my view is that what we want is we want loose fiscal and we want tighter monetary policy together until we get to full employment. And by doing that, you avoid slamming on the brakes with inflation the way that Summers talks about, the way that Dudley talks about. I think that's a much better way of getting things done. So I don't think we're there, but we're halfway there.
I have to say, Chair Harrison has a nice ring to it.
Yes.
If I could add my two cents, I think that the spirit of the question, Japanification, extremely reduced volatility in currencies, in equities, that the backstop is always there. Sure, I see that. I think it's quite apparent. I would highlight two differences. Number one is demographics. Japan is a very, very old country, and that is perhaps why it's needed such a large amount of quantitative easing, of asset purchases. And the U.S., we're an old country too, but we have a somewhat vibrant immigration system, and immigrants tend to be younger, so we sort of have this renewal. We're sort of aging at this incredible rate that Japan is, that Europe is. That's number one. Number two, I just think in terms of scale, I think the scale of the Bank of Japan's interventions really have, we're nowhere close to there. I mean, if you read Princes of the Yen by Professor Richard Werner, I mean, there was a time when there was a city square, I believe, or perhaps a park, a very small plot of land in Tokyo that had a greater market value than the entire state of California. Likewise, I was actually reading a book by Peter
Tokyo Lynch. Imperial Palace.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Ash, always there. I appreciate it. And then I was actually reading a book by Peter Lynch. He was noting that there was a recent IPO, a public offering of a old, basically like a telecom stock. It was sort of like an AT&T stock, but it was very small, very old, not growing quickly, and it was worth more than AT&T and Bell and all these other stocks combined. Obviously that was a result of the Bank of Japan's unprecedented intervention. So I don't think we're there yet. Could we get there? Of course. But I don't think we're as close as perhaps some people think.
Jack, what are you worried about? It's not like the Fed.
I was there at the time. So you're talking NTT. And so I remember those things. So when you talk about these things historically, I'm thinking about them as they actually happened. And that was part of the internet bubble that we had as well. We had stocks that I think were pretty ridiculous a decade later, but we were able to recover from that. It's that that housing stuff where there's debt allocated. That's the thing that really gets you.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Right. Yeah, NTT Docomo. Jack, I don't know why you're so worried. It's not like the Fed is ever going to buy corporate securities. Come on.
That's fair. I mean, yeah, that's true.
By the way, we're joking, of course. The Fed is under the 13-3 program. It's done precisely that since the beginning of the COVID crisis. But still, to your point, Jack, absolutely nowhere near the scale relative to the capital markets in Japan that we've experienced in the U.S.
I got something. Ash, you're absolutely right. They did do that under that program. They didn't buy as much simply because they didn't have to. So I'll say this. The Rubicon has been crossed, but they're not at Rome yet. I'll say that.
Wading into the Rubicon, the title of your memoir. It'll be like you're slouching toward Gamora, Jack. It has potential.
There we go.
Here's one from Alan Givray. Deflation or inflation, euro dollar-based debt deflation versus dollar collapse and hyperinflation. But the spirit of his question, Ed, really about deflation versus inflation, we've been talking about the inflation risk during this conversation, but nothing on those who have been talking about the risk for incredible or increasing, I should say, deflation based largely on the technological drivers that we see and the automation in, and offshoring of work.
Yeah. So your question is about inflation and deflation. Can you repeat that question one more time?
Sure. So Alan Givray says inflation or deflation, and then his specific question, and this is a little bit more in the weeds, so we can address the broader picture if you like, Ed. Euro dollar based deflation versus dollar collapse hyperinflation. Obviously, he's talking about the implications for this in the currency market.
Yeah, you know, when people start talking about hyperinflation and dollar collapse and things like that, generally, I think that I would consider those outlier events. So if you're looking for, you know, something that could potentially, it's like Dogecoin going to a dollar. It could, let's say Dogecoin going to $10. You know, maybe you want to put 1% of your basket into that thought. But really, it's probably not going to happen. There are special circumstances that would allow it to happen. I think that when we're looking at the inflation numbers, I think Jim Bianco is probably right when he says, look, I'm only talking like 2.6 inflation. I'm an inflationista, but I'm not talking about even 1970 style inflation. Even if you got 2.6% on a persistent basis, that would be enough to change bond yields dramatically, large enough such that you would have huge losses on your bond portfolio. So you don't really need to see dramatic changes to see some big changes just from an investing perspective.
Yeah. By the way, on a lighter note, we took a bet, I think it was last week, about whether Doge was going to be higher or lower. Although I'm bearish on Doge secularly, I said higher, and we're now trading at about, just under 33 cents, up from where we were last week. So the Doge rally continues week
up. I think every time we do this, I think that this is the drinking word. If there are people who are pounding brews right now, every single time we say Doge, they have to take a sip.
Yeah.
Ed, you talking about pounding brews and wearing a dark green shirt, I almost feel like you're in a fraternity at Dartmouth.
Yeah, the Dartmouth green is a little bit, it's a little darker than this. And, it's like they say in Vegas, you know, everything stays in Hanover.
Animal House did not, though. That went on to be a global phenomenon.
Yes, definitely.
By the way, so you mentioned hyperinflation. I'm actually reading a pretty famous book now, Lords of Finance. And so just getting into the Weimar Republic, that was an incredibly intentional decision by the Reichsbank to devalue the currency. So, you know, it's a common, you know, if you're a debtor, if you owe money, you love it when the currency that your debt is denominated in goes down in value. So it was intentional. And by the way, people were reporting, doctors were reporting patients had psychosomatic illnesses where because the price of bread would go from $100 to $300, you know, over the course of a week, patients had illnesses where they were like, yeah, I'm 40 trillion years old. I have 2 trillion children. They would say that in, you know, parlance.
Wow. That is interesting. I hadn't heard that. Ed, here's a question that just sounds like it was custom tailored for you. Balu, the carefree bear Q, what is your take on short end US rates moving lower while long end moving mostly higher? Is this collateral demand? And if so, how does one square this with the quote expectations hypothesis?
Expectations hypothesis. Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, technically you can have some movement. You know, because if you take a look at the curve and you derive it into, what you think the interest rate should be in 3 months or in 10 years over time, and then there's a premium based on liquidity for different times in the term structure, you can build out a yield curve, but there's going to be some movement around that. So, for instance, I think that if you look at the short end of the curve, we could even have negative rates, mildly negative, just for pure technical reasons. And then if you have gangbusters economy, closing the gap to the previous level of unemployment, you could still see rates going up somewhat. So you could see the yield curve steepening, via both ends of the yield curve. But I don't really think that the short end of the yield curve has a lot of room down in terms of how far negative you can go, just because unless the Fed is telling you that they're going to go negative or you fear that they're going to go negative, there's no reason for yields to go very substantially negative.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys are watching the comments, but they're absolutely ripping. Doing this live is just so much fun and so cool. And it's great to be doing this with you and to be interacting in real time and reading the questions. You're welcome, Alan. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly. So here's a question as we get toward the close. I've been eager to ask both of you. It comes to us from Echoing Owl. And the question is, what's the dinner choice Friday night, Ash, Ed, and Jack?
Jack.
Ooh, man. Well, let's see. I think for a snack I had before this, I had an arugula salad with some bacon bits that I made. I may have some pasta and chicken from last night. Sorry to, wish I could say something a little more interesting. Last Friday, I did go to quite a very interesting sake bar downtown with a few of my buddies. And there the food was very good. But Ed, how about yourself?
Who are you having dinner with? John Kerry? This is 1% stuff.
Dick for that, by the way. Because as soon as you say arugula, I'm thinking, I don't know if you know, back from 2008 when Barack Obama was on the campaign trail, people was talking to him about food prices. They were like, have you seen the food prices, like the price that we're paying for food? And the first words out of his mouth was like, yeah, the price of arugula is going through the roof. And I had to laugh because I don't even know what arugula is. My meal is going to be whatever whatever is served to me, whatever I can get.
Good answer, Ed. Good answer.
From takeout or McDonald's or whatever it might be. So I'm a little bit more basic, I imagine.
Jack, are you having dinner with John Kerry tonight?
No, you say that because I eat arugula. I must be such a hoity-toity fancy lad.
It sounds like you might be. I don't know. I don't want to accuse you here, but it sounds like you might be.
I think President Obama was unfairly maligned for his comment. I think I am too.
Hey, you know what I'm having for dinner tonight? I'm going to Bear Burger and I'm getting grass-fed beef hamburgers because now dining in New York indoors is open again. And the pleasure of eating scalding hot burgers with melting cheese is something that I have just missed and craved. I do not cook. I'm a classic New York City bachelor. Fridge is totally empty. So I've been ordering food in except for maybe a bowl of cereal in the morning. So going out and having scalding hot burgers with dripping melting cheese, sauteed onions, just absolutely delicious. That's the plan for tonight.
Sounds good. I like it.
Yeah, I'm pretty hungry. Listen to that.
Jack, you should meet me. It's in your hood.
You're not going to the one on 88th and 1st, are you?
Is there one? Yeah, I think that is the one I'm going to.
Oh, wow. Small world. Very close to my neighborhood.
Well, now anyone who's in New York, they know where to get you guys. They can ask some more questions after. I like it.
Yeah, it's like the Real Vision Daily Briefing after hours.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Buy these guys a drink.
Yeah, we should do it at PJ Clark's at some point for all of our New York listeners and viewers.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. There's a place that our head of business, George, took me to a while back. It's called Bathtub Gin. It's one of those places that it's so cool that it doesn't have a sign. And it's actually a really cool place. I went there again with a few friends 2 weekends ago. And yeah, that we should have something there. It's very old fashioned. It's kind of like a speakeasy vibe. Good place for everything.
Jack, too cool to have a sign. You're not doing any yourself any favors here with not sounding hoity-toity. Okay. So, gentlemen, as we come to a close here, we're at about almost the hour mark now. We've run long, as we always do on these Friday briefings, but it's been a lot of fun. Final thoughts that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, we've been all positive and so forth, so I don't want to bring negativity, but I'm generally positive on the U.S. economy. I think that the U.S. economy is going to outperform for at least a good 3 months. Europe is behind, but you know they're going to be coming out of it. The place to watch in terms of outperformance or underperformance is actually Asia, because you know they're the ones who supposedly came out of the pandemic the best, the earliest. They've been outperforming, but really some of the things that you've seen, and I'm not talking about India, I'm talking about elsewhere, suggest that we still have worries until you know we get herd immunity. We don't know what's going to happen. So right now, the U.S. is the best bet over the short term in terms of outperformance.
Yeah, China, Asia, that really is key because they consume so many commodities. Oil, copper have been surging. So if you see a slowdown in China, that could put an ice bath on that commodity rally. One thing I have my eye on is rising yields in Europe, which Ed, I know you have your eye on as well, and that makes it slightly more attractive for capital to flow into Europe, which would be good for the euro. But really, I want to close with a thought that is kind of simple, because Ash, Ed, you guys think at a pretty high level. We've kind of been talking like above the rim, but I just want to close with a very simple thought, which is that the stock market is up, and that the Nasdaq has had has had positive months for the past, I believe, 5 months. So all this, yields are going to rise and that's going to be kryptonite for tech stocks, which, by the way, I was saying, I was wrong. People who said that were completely wrong. The S&P 500 yesterday made all-time highs. And I actually was just looking at a technical indicator, which is breadth, which is the percentage of stocks in an index which participate in the rally. And in April, we had the best monthly breadth on record. 95% or more of U.S. equity benchmarks closed above their 200-day moving average in 18 sessions for all the trading sessions in that month. So it's literally the best on record. So your economic optimism, Ed, is clearly shared by equity investors. That's all I'll say.
And before Ash leaves with his final word, I don't think you were wrong, Jack. I think you were right. It's just that we've taken a pause. What happens if rates go to 2% or 2.3%? It might be different. I think we're in the Goldilocks period, at least for right now. And so let's enjoy it for the time being. But if rates rise again, I don't think that picture is going to look quite the same.
Here's what I'm thinking about, guys. Burgers and beer. I'm thinking about it right now because that's what I'm craving. And I'm also thinking about it because New York City is in the middle of a reopening, going to 75% internal capacity for dining next week, I believe May 7th, a week from today. This is something that's going to be really interesting to see what is going to happen here in the financial capital of the United States as this reopening trade happens. I was out last night, went to my first party post-pandemic. It's really, really weird talking to people when they're not wearing masks. It's weird being indoors. It's just like super surreal. I did my first indoor dinner this week. And the thing that killed me, and if you've recently gone out and you've been locked up for a long time in your apartment, like I have, it was the echoes in the restaurant. I would hear people talking, at the table, like behind me, and I couldn't filter it out because I hadn't been in a space where there were other people talking. It's a really weird experience. I know people in other areas of the country where they didn't lock down quite as hard as we did here in New York City, obviously with the intense population density and the incredible, incredible carnage that we had last year in the spring. But it is a really surreal feeling. So I'm thinking about burgers and beer. I'm thinking about what's going to happen with the animal spirits. Obviously, as Ed pointed out, 21% rise in incomes. Obviously, this is some impact from the fiscal stimulus. But it's going to be really interesting to see what this summer looks like. Are we going to have Roaring Twenties Part 2? And if so, what's the impact that it's going to have on the animal spirits of the economy? That's what I'm thinking about right now, and thinking about it in the context of actually ordering a burger and a beer.
Excellent. Sounds good. Well, have lots of fun, you guys. I hope that the two of you have a great time at your burger place tonight. And hopefully I'll see you in New York sometime soon.
Yeah. And Ash, for next week, you can't forget the net. Okay.
I'll definitely remember. I'll prop it up on the bookshelf. Ed, Jack, thanks so much for joining us. Thank you so much for watching, everyone. Thank you for participating in the conversation.